Hello, and welcome to a brand new season of the CoverCast podcast. This podcast is an initiative of the Cover Project, and our hope is to engage with Christian faculty in higher education through highlighting their research, their scholarship, teaching, and service in order to bridge connections between university, church, and society. Hosting this podcast is myself, Penina Achayo-Laker, and I'm here with my most esteemed co-host, John Inazu. John and I are both faculty at Washington University in St. Louis and fellows with the Carver Project. We remain so thankful to you for listening and to all our guests from season one for the enriching and very thoughtful conversations that we shared. We're looking forward to yet another crop of guests this season and looking forward to having thought-provoking conversations. And to help us kick us off things today, we are so excited to spend some time with a friend, Roz. Welcome to the CoverCast podcast.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with you both.
Roz, it's so good to be with you. For our listeners, Roz is the founder and director of the Affective Computing Research Group at MIT, MIT's Media Lab, and also has co-founded a bunch of companies and other initiatives that I'm sure we'll talk about. But to get us going, Roz, the first thing that comes to mind when I think about you is when we were last together, you hooked up a bunch of devices on me and monitored my stress levels while I was giving a presentation. And it was incredibly, it was awesome, but it was also a bit unnerving. So maybe that's a way, before we kind of get into your background and your work, do you want to just sort of tell us a bit about what was going on in that moment?
Well, I hope you were fully consented and informed.
Absolutely. The good lawyer that I am, of course.
Yeah. I have been interested in a long time in understanding and from a more engineering and scientific perspective, emotions and how they work in our brains, how they help us be smarter, how they help us make wise decisions, how they help build relationships and contribute to well-being. And my background is engineering, not psychology. So I came to the topic wanting to make things precise and reliable and repeatable, which has turned into quite a challenge, which meant we had to build a lot of our own technology to measure things. And one of those was an early wearable that has evolved quite a bit over the years. And that's probably one of the versions that you kindly wore during your talk. Now it's bringing back memories. Yes.
Yeah. And tell us a bit about what's remarkable to me is kind of what that technology and that device enables. I mean, we're talking about saving human lives, which is a pretty great place to be working.
It took some surprising twists and turns. You know, if I'd known then where it led to now, I would have never believed it. I would have just said, oh, no, that can't happen. And here it happened. So, you know, wow, surprises definitely await all of us who go into research.
Right. Well, maybe now that I got us kind of poised with that nice teaser.
I know. I'm excited now.
Do you want to maybe just tell us a bit about kind of how you got to where you are? And you know, you said there were some unanticipated surprises, but maybe, you don't just kind of get to be a leading inventor, engineer, scientist by accident. So there's a path, and tell us a little bit about the background.
Yeah, well, in this particular case, I started by just wanting to understand emotion, and we built devices that could leave the lab, because when you try to elicit emotion in the lab, you know, like, hey, come in here and do this thing that makes you feel happy or sad, or look at these pictures that you know you're going to say, those make me feel afraid. They don't really make you feel that, right? You just kind of know that there's a little bit of that feeling. And one of our participants left the lab once and said, you know, that anger you elicited in the lab? Well, that was nothing compared with when I was talking to my boyfriend after leaving the lab. And I thought, you know, we need to build the lab that leaves the lab, right? We need to make the lab wearable. We need to make it go into your real world if we're going to understand what's really happening in your real world. What's really happening when a child is growing up in a home with incredible stress or is out on a playground and experiencing bullying, or you know, you're in a workplace and maybe you're not really aware of your feelings. A lot of people aren't, actually. They're alexithymic and they may need help kind of understanding what's preceding that eruption, that meltdown. And in particular, we were working with people on the autism spectrum who often really say their feelings kind of explode without prior warning. You know, I thought I was fine and then all of a sudden I lost it. What happened? You know, could I get an early warning for this? So we thought, gee, I don't know, but maybe we could build something to measure it and start to understand it better. So we decided we had to build measurement that could leave the lab. And that meant not just the sensors and the science, but design and form factors, and started with like little scrunchy sweatbands and stuffing electronics in them and all kinds of crazy contraptions that only us people from MIT would be caught in public wearing. but we, you know, we went out there with all these different things and evolved them until they actually worked to collect different signals. And one of them was picking up electrical changes from the surface of the skin, a signal that's long been studied in lie detection, usually from the fingertips. And we had been exploring different ways to get it, you know, and get meaningful information that wasn't related to lying, but that was related to stress. And in particular, kids who are non-speaking, who on the autism spectrum have very different ways of communicating and have a hard time producing words, they were often being misunderstood, we learned. So some of them had said, you know, could you build me a device that helps my stress be better understood? So we did that, a piece of their stress, not all of their stress. And one day, one of the undergrads in my lab asked if he could borrow it for his little brother who has autism and is non-speaking. And I said, sure. In fact, don't just take one, take two, you know, because they were always breaking back then. So do you need a soldering iron? And he's like, no, I have a soldering iron. I'm like, good, MIT students, you know, they're ready to fix things. And anyhow, he goes home over Christmas break, puts these devices on his little brother. I'm back at MIT in my office looking at the boy's data, and most of it looked really chill, very calm. Not what I expected to see in a kid who, you know, they were concerned about his stress levels. And then as I go to the next day's data, it wasn't flat. There was this huge peak, bigger than any peak we had ever seen, you know, and I thought we were pretty good at getting stress peaks at MIT. You know, we do qualifying exams and drill people in front of people, and we've done Boston driver stress and all kinds of things. And this peak, you know, dwarfed all those others. This was like a redwood tree popping out of a New England forest. And I thought, you know, what is going on here? And after unsuccessfully debugging it with my engineering hat on, I resorted to an old-fashioned phone call and called the student and said, do you have any idea what's going on with your little brother at this time in this data? And he said, I don't know, but I'll check the diary. And I thought, diary? You know, MIT student keeps a diary? And said like a quick prayer, like, you know, really, like, what are the odds that this teenager wrote down, you know, what happened at this particular time over Christmas vacation? And he comes back and he has the exact date and time written down and said that was when his little brother had a grand mal seizure. So this was the beginning of learning about a whole bunch of things going on in our brains that I was not expecting to learn about.
Wow. I am truly amazed, one, by just the level of empathy and thoughtfulness that you are able to bring to the experience of creating these devices, especially by what you said, building devices that can leave the lab. I really love that concept. I'm curious about how large your teams are, because you're working with audiences that are vulnerable, one, because they're younger, but also they are dealing with such complex health issues. What do your teams look like when you're working on these projects?
We are dealing with real complexity, autism, epilepsy. It's amazing how we have like one word labels for things that are phenomenally heterogeneous. You know, they say if you know a person with autism, then you know one person with autism. You know, it's so different. Our team is very diverse and yet never as big and diverse as we need to really cover everything. Just about everybody wears multiple hats. And in fact, I'm going through admissions right now, and it's such a struggle to make these choices because I know I want people who see things differently than I do. It's always important to not just add people to our team who kind of have backgrounds like we do, but to go beyond that, to always try to find somebody who has had experiences or you know, a different path. And so my team right now is a little smaller than usual because I deliberately shrunk it before sabbatical and graduated a lot of people. But typically we're about, 15 to 30 people working with backgrounds that range from, engineering to psychology, neuroscience, right, to design, really just about any skill is welcome. We can use it all. But I'd say what's most common is that everybody is willing to learn and keep learning and learn things in areas where they don't have training, to learn beyond the boundaries of what's expected. And everybody's very driven to try to figure out how to understand people and their problems and shape the technology to help people as opposed to just shape the technology to help advance our own careers.
Right. And speaking of complexity, I could imagine this other variable of time that also plays into this mix, these processes take a while, and I would imagine you might not always necessarily have a perfect timestamp that this is going to take us 1 year to do, because sometimes you just never know what you're going to find. How do you deal with that?
You learn to be comfortable with things that are uncomfortable. You learn to be, you have to be accepting of uncertainty. I recommend keeping several things going at once in parallel, not too many so that you're totally, pulled into different directions, but not putting all your eggs in one basket. We at any given time have a bunch of different projects moving forward, and I always have a few on the sidelines that I'm kind of pondering in the back of my head, and they're not quite ready yet, right? They're waiting for something. And sometimes you may be waiting for 6 months, 5 years. In some cases, we've waited for 10 years for some breakthrough we needed to get to the next step. And things have different timescales, and they're not in our hands. I don't ever operate under an illusion that I have control over things. You control the things you can control, but most of it you really can't. And if you have this illusion that you're controlling it, well, you might want to question that too. Yeah.
Roz, you had a fascinating, very public profile about your Christian faith and Christianity Today a couple of years ago. And particularly, what struck me about, many things struck me about that profile, but one of them was the wrestling with intellectual depth and, being taken seriously as a intellectual and someone who takes seriously science and ideas, and then coming to grips with a Christianity compatible with that. I mean, so first of all, it's a striking profile. We'll link to it on our podcast page. But I wonder if you could talk about maybe a little bit about that process of coming to terms with the mutuality of inquiry and the mind and faith. And then also, I'd be interested to know how you balance that in your professional role and profile today.
Yeah, I think, one of the things I'm a little worried about in society today is I hate to say the word marketing, but maybe, that's one way of thinking about it, that when well-educated, thoughtful Christians get quiet and only ones who maybe aren't quite as thoughtful get loud. If there were a marketing department watching this, they would try to rebalance that a little bit, right? Everybody has a voice, and that's important. But sometimes when people don't speak out, then they're still saying something, right? And that is sometimes leaving people who don't know with an impression that it is a particular way that it's not actually. And we, when I was young and a very staunch atheist, my impression of Christianity was actually very different from reality, now that I know a little bit more about the reality. But it was based on what I saw and heard in the media. And if you think about just how Christianity is portrayed in the media, it's actually pretty horrifying. And it's gotten worse, I think. And we're letting it get worse. I say we now, since I went from being an atheist to being a Christian. So I'm pondering sometimes, like, should we speak out more and more boldly? And so I applaud what the Carver Project and others are doing to get those of us who, you know, maybe it's not appropriate to suddenly bring up my Christian faith in the middle of a derivation of the Fourier transform lecture. but I can still speak out when it is appropriate. And it is important that we all speak out, not that we have perfect knowledge, which we don't have, or that we're better than others, which we aren't, or any of that, but just that there are very important intellectual views that arise compatibly with the Christian worldview and are valuable. They're hugely valuable in our world right now. For example, the conversations around justice and compassion. Mm-hmm. And driving all of my work from the beginning, you know, has been this belief that came not from myself, but came from Christian teaching, that all people are made in God's image, they've all got infinite worth. And so when I'm talking in a room in Beijing, which I lasted several years ago, and people were asking me, like, why are you working to help people with autism? You know, as if like a person at MIT should be above that, they were thinking.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, oh my goodness, you know, these people have, I said to them, they have taught me so much. Everybody should work with them. They're wonderful. Their minds are fascinating. They're, you know, almost all of my work and thinking has been influenced by conversations and moments spent with people on the autism spectrum in beneficial ways. And we have so much to learn from different minds. And one of them said, well, we saw autism and several people with disabilities as coming into this life being punished for something they did in a previous life. You know, and I thought, wow, what a different worldview, right? If your religion teaches you that some people are better than others, then, you know, that takes you to a certain place in the kinds of problems you work on. And, you know, Christianity teaches that we're all of infinite worth, you know, which gave me the freedom and, you know, an encouragement to go work with a lot of people that others thought we shouldn't be working with. And it's, you know, absolutely wonderful. So I think we need to bring this Christian worldview into conversations, you know, not necessarily to tell people what they should believe, but because it's an incredibly valuable view.
Mm-hmm. Have you found any opportunities to maybe even thinking about this Christian witness on a more micro view on the classroom as you're teaching and as a Christian faculty? Have there been opportunities for you I don't even know if the word is witness, but I guess I'm curious what your experiences have been as a Christian faculty.
Yeah, you know, it's always, you have to find the right balance. That's, you know, I think on the, not, I won't say comfortable for you. I think it's better to be on the border of being uncomfortable, but still, you know, where you feel driven to go. Mm. I, coming out of an atheist background where I couldn't stand when people shared their faith, like I just hated it. I would go to the other side of the street. it was, so that makes me a little sensitive to how it's shared. I do, I want to not hide it. So like if we were physically sitting in my office, you would notice on the shelves, several Bibles and books about faith alongside my engineering books and my math books and lots of other books, you know, cause I think it deserves a prominent, place. It should be visible. I'd like to bring in quote of the day, you know, on back in the days when we were physically there and writing on the whiteboard. I hope these days are coming by the time this is aired. Return.
Let's hope so.
we, you know, I write a quote of the day, and sometimes it's a Bible verse, sometimes it's something else. But, you know, hey, that's a huge part of my mind share now, right? Because I like to read the scriptures regularly. And so it's there. There have been times when I have brought it up in private conversations with students, offered to pray for them. Even non-Christians sometimes really appreciate an offer to prayer. I usually precede it with, if this makes you uncomfortable, we don't have to go down this path. It perks up their ears. And so far, nobody's ever resisted that path. But some might, and I don't bring it up with everybody, right? It has to feel like it's the right time and moment. But yeah, it's such an important part of what's made a big difference in my life and making, and getting guidance. I mean, step back and think for a moment. If you could get guidance from the most amazing mind in the whole world, like, you know, if you're in a particular field, like John in law or in politics or whatever your field is, if you could pick the brains of the most amazing mind in that field and get guidance, wouldn't you want to?
Yes.
And, you know, we have this opportunity to hear from the mind behind all those minds, right? The mind behind the whole universe, behind every field of inquiry. And I just think that is just so profound and incredible that we should encourage one another to go listen to that mind.
I love that. I want to jump back to something you said a few minutes ago that I've been mulling, and it was the connection you made between the seeing people as image bearers and notions of justice. And then implicit in what you said was this sense of empathy. And I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking through so many levels of in higher ed and in our worlds that value a kind of cognitive mastery or certain locutions or certain insider codes to be able to start to reset the premise and say every single person is an image bearer. The less educated person, the less cognitively able person, my enemy, the brash person I encounter on social media, that all of them are image bearers. And if we could harness the kind of empathy that you're conveying there, if we could model that as Christians, that would be a really great place to reset our engagement in the world.
Yeah.
It just seems like we have so many resources to situate a conversation about justice that starts with the claim of people being image bearers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And instead of it being the image du jour, right, of the sort of identity politics or whatever, it's the person in front of you, whoever they are, and however much they're disagreeing with you, right? Mm-hmm. You just start there. It's easy to rattle off the phrase, love your enemies, right? But it's really hard sometimes when you just feel like scowling or they're attacking you, and especially if they're being unfair or, short-sighted or whatever, to be filled with that love and try to show them understanding. One of the most powerful tools we've learned, actually, I learned it from trying to teach an AI how to do it, and it's actually wound up helping me, we tried to teach the computer how to show active listening and empathy. Now, it doesn't feel empathy, okay? Don't get the idea that it actually feels anything. It doesn't. It doesn't actually even think or know anything. It's not conscious. But it can take the text that it's given, and it can learn how to try to respond to that in very limited, narrow context and make it sound like it's empathizing with you. And as we worked out the algorithms to do this, I started trying them in my real life. and they really help. And it has made such a huge difference but if you look at what we're actually trying to do, it's trying to show somebody when a human does it that they're truly understood. When the computer does it, it's not so genuine. It's much more trying to look as if it's understanding.
I don't know if this is the perfect time to do this, but I'm now really curious to hear about just how you got started in this, where your passion for tinkering, engineering, creating, making, take us all the way back to your early school days and how you modeled this pathway for yourself.
Well, it's funny because these days I read applications from people who've been building cool stuff since they were kids, or at least they hate that story. Mine was more, my mom was a special needs teacher and my dad was an engineer. And I made a lot of stuff with arts and crafts, but I actually hated science. I thought science was boring. And my first experience was like, you know, with dead worms that smelled of formaldehyde. I mean, it was awful. Like, who wanted to do that kind of science? It was only later in college, really, when I was looking for something to do, because I loved math and I loved architecture and I loved kind of starting to think about how things worked, that I was encouraged to really give engineering a try, which I just wound up loving and, you know, was very well matched to. I could handle that much better than history, which I also thought was really interesting. But for some reason, I always fell asleep during class in history. So history didn't work out. But engineering, making things, understanding things, deriving things, logic was a great match for me. And after I got a taste of it, I just wanted to do more. I wanted to know how everything worked. I wanted to design computers from the transistors on up and, you know, just try to figure out how the brain worked after that. Then I wanted to build a machine that worked like the brain. Then I wanted to, you know, in the beginning, I was very enamored by AI and the notion of building a machine that could do everything a human could do. And as time went on, and I was talking with one of my friends and colleagues, Marvin Minsky, who's considered one of the founding parents of the field of AI. And Marvin would say, you know, oh, with AI, someday we're going to build a machine that's so incredible that we'll be lucky if it keeps us around as a household pet. And I thought, oh no.
I'm scared.
Really? You know, is my legacy going to be that my great-grandchildren are lucky to be kept around as a household pet? And I thought, you know, I'm suddenly not quite as enamored with this AI idea that I was before. I mean, it's amazing to think about our minds and to think about how they work by trying to build them. It's another thing to try to build something that you know, denigrates human beings, right? And that did not sit well with me. So what I found when I came to the Media Lab after leaving the other side of MIT, which is where the AI lab was, that the Media Lab also wanted to build intelligence in technology, but for a very different goal. Our goal was not to build the AI that is so amazing that, you know, we're nothing in comparison, but to build the kinds of AIs that help humans be more amazing, that help humans do more than we could do. So, for example, the wearable that started off measuring stress that we found accidentally had this humongous signal with the most life-threatening kind of seizures, we have now built the kind of AI that can run inside a wrist-worn device, detect those seizures with high sensitivity and with very low false alarm rate, good enough that it's now approved by the FDA, or officially they say cleared by the FDA. And that device running the AI in the wrist now is not out there replacing people. It's out there working with people to augment their ability. So they augment their ability to have some independence and yet summon somebody at the moment of their need. So our goal is to take AI and to try to figure out how to interweave it in human lives to make human lives better, not to replace something that we value about one another.
I love that. I was struck as you were talking about your college days. For me, it was the exact inverse. I was also an engineering major in college, minor in history. And it became very clear to me that engineering was not my thing. And I, you know, grew to love the humanistic kind of writing process. And so it's just fascinating how these interventions.
Isn't it great that we're, there's so many different kinds of people in the world. We yes. need all of this for that unique person out there who's feeling like they don't fit in. If you don't feel like you fit in, that's wonderful. That's exactly what we want. Right.
I think that's right.
More people it's like the more you don't fit in, the more we need you, the more you fit in.
Right. And increasingly, we just need outside the box kind of thinking in all kinds of parts of society.
Yeah. If there's nobody like you in that role, then that's more likely that's where you're needed, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I wonder, you know, you've, Roz, you've had a lot of success and you have a lot of demands on your time. And so I wonder if you could reflect a bit on how you handle success and time pressures as someone, you know, for whom the various responsibilities you have had and continue to have will put demands on you. But how do you balance that with being, you know, having other roles, being a human being, being a wife and a mom, and then trying to stay grounded and not too, you know, concerned about yourself, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah, it's hard. This is where the scriptures help a lot, you know, kind of reminding us that it's not about us and not tooting our own horns, but it's about others. And also, I found it really helpful. I wish I remember who first told me this, to get priorities right, to get kind of a rightly ordered life. And I won't tell other people what that is for them, but for me, it's putting God first. You know, first I'm a child of God, and what an incredible privilege that is, right? And after that, number two is my marriage. For those who are married and have children, I really urge you to put your marriage before your children. You know, and so my husband, who I've been married to since 1988, proof of a miracle that anybody would stay married to me that long, is you know, is my priority. Then my children. And family. And then after that, you know, MIT and, you know, and some of my friends are like family too. And then MIT and then other startup companies and all that stuff, right? Whereas some people sort of invert that, right? They make their tenure case their number one priority, mm-hmm. and then their marriage falls apart and then their children, you know, struggle. And I just think that getting your faith, your philosophy of life, that stuff first is, you know, critical. And then the marriage, then the children, and family, and so forth. And of course, basic health, physical and mental health. It's critical, right? If you're not getting enough sleep, you can't really think properly about God or your family or any of that stuff. So I really do pay attention to, faith and health and relationships. And then all the other stuff will take an infinite amount of time if you let it, right? So you really can't put work first because it will just take over everything and then everything else will suffer and then you will suffer and then you can't do work. So number one, rightly ordering those things is really important. And I just, you know, turning to the scriptures about loving others before yourself, putting others before yourself, it's just critical. And you know, I think at the end of this life, that's, you know, I've heard nobody really wants at the end of this life that they have a few more publications on their resume, or raised a few more $1 million, or that they made a few more revenues at their startup or whatever. But they do often bemoan the fact that they didn't spend enough time with certain relationships, with certain people, or deepen some friendships or other things. So it's important, I think, to keep the perspectives of what really matters in your life in front of you and keep trying to go back to them, right? Because all these other forces will pull you away from them.
Wow. I really appreciate hearing those reflections and just perspectives coming from someone like you who's very accomplished in what you do, but is also able to, you know, just to go back and think about the things that actually really matter. I think for a lot of us, junior faculty on the tenure track and trying to live, you know, a godly life and be a wife and be a mom and be present, the pressures everywhere can sometimes feel really overwhelming. But I really appreciate that reminder of what really matters when it's all said and done, and that reminder to think about for whom we do what we do and how important our faith is in all of this. Really appreciate that. I cannot believe we are really at that point where we need to wrap up because of time. I was thinking about how I have all these little extra things I would love to ask you. But as we conclude, maybe if I could pick just one piece that stood out to me that I would love you to maybe throw more light on and end with, is it, you know, the work that you do involves quite a bit of emotion, not just that you're studying emotions, but also you're dealing with topics and people who are going through situations that I would imagine can feel emotional, even for you and just for your own mental health and well-being. And I'm curious, I guess, from your perspective, how you handle that specific aspect of emotion. I know that in the design field, I'm a communication designer, and a lot of my work is community-based and tends to touch on topics that are that can feel draining, because these are social issues that don't have to be the way they be. And when you immerse yourself into those contexts and through empathy are able to sit with people, listen to their stories and understand, sometimes I find that I take that home with me, and it's sometimes hard to compartmentalize. I know John will just, you know, sometimes just compartmentalize these things. but Roz, I'm curious to hear from you. How do you handle that? The emotions that come with all of that.
I think one of the things that, so first of all, I just recognize emotions are important. In the beginning, I used to think, oh, these are just undesirable. And later I thought, oh my goodness, these are actually playing an important role. Even though some of my colleagues would come up to me, and you'd kind of have to be there to see me act this out. They'd like look at my feet, okay, not my face, and say, Roz, why are you working on emotion? Emotion's irrelevant. It's just noise, you know? Like, well, you know, so there are people who really don't get emotion. And I work with a lot of them. At the same time, everybody has emotion. And usually when it bubbles up, it usually means something matters. So it's really not a good idea to ignore it. And I think the thing to do is to not only try to understand it, which is step one, but whether or not you succeed at step one, to get to step two. And step two is where you try to show the other person what you're seeing of their emotion. You know, you might say, for example, it sounds like that's pretty frustrating. Is that right? You know, and allow them to correct you. Okay. It sounds like that may be kind of upsetting. Is that right? Or it sounds like that's pretty annoying or dismaying, or you might feel betrayed, or like get a list of emotion words and try to figure out if you can put a word or a phrase to what it is they might be feeling, and show them the honor and the dignity of trying to understand and put into words what it is they're feeling. And when you do that, when you don't just simply try to understand what they're feeling, but you try to make an effort to describe it back to them, even if you don't get it right, okay, if you're willing to try and give them a chance to correct you, it is like giving them air. It's like giving them oxygen. And it's amazing. It can help them not only to affirm that feeling, but to also get past that feeling. So especially if you see somebody stuck in rage or frustration or despair or whatever emotion they're kind of getting stuck in, if you go over and try to give words to it and help figure out how to help them give words to it, sometimes that alone is a huge gift, and it can help them get past it, get past a problem that you don't know how to fix, but they are stuck. And sometimes giving them that gift helps them get unstuck.
Wow. If my wife listens to this, she's going to say that's the prophetic word mic drop for me right there. That was fantastic. That was a perfect way to bring us to a wrap here. Yes. Roz, thanks so much. This has been awesome. And thanks for taking the time to be with us. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing you again.
Me too. Thank you for what you all are doing. I wish you the very best. Thank you so much for your service.
Thanks, Roz.
Thank you.